This episode of the Police One podcast is sponsored by Officer Store. Learn more about getting the gear you need at prices you can afford by visiting officerstore.com. Hey, welcome back. You're listening to Policing Matters on policeone.com. I'm your host, Jim Dudley. Welcome back. Be sure and check out our videos and graphics on the YouTube channel as well. And you can take a glimpse of me and today's guest, Brian Lovins. Well, we don't discuss a lot in regards to corrections departments on the show, but we should. Today, we're talking about management in jails and prisons. Specifically, how can we use data-driven applications and technology to assess risk to keep corrections officers safe and the incarcerated as well? Well, Brian Lovins, PhD, is a principal for Justice System Partners. He earned his PhD in criminology from the University of Cincinnati and is the past president of the American Probation and Parole Association, APA. Dr. Lovins routinely helps jurisdictions understand their local systems, helps stakeholders analyze and interpret their data, and provides practical, real-world solutions to addressing today's justice system challenges. Well, welcome to Policing Matters, Brian Lovins.
Awesome, Jim, and thank you. And thank you to your audience for having me. I really appreciate sort of the work that you guys have done. I've taken a look at some of the past podcasts that you've done and really excited to be part of this and part of the conversation. So thank you.
Yeah, me too. And like I said in the intro, we don't talk about the correction side, right? We just catch them and take them to the DA and prosecute them. And, you know, if we're lucky, they get prosecuted and convicted and then they go to jail or prison. And then we just sort of, you know, clap our hands and we're done and move on to the next. Well, you know, we're dealing with some dangerous individuals out on the streets, but inside jails and prisons, the corrections officers are dealing with 100% people who have been convicted a lot of times of a violent crime. So what's your approach when you reach a corrections agency that they contact you? Are they asking for an audit or a presentation to improve their services? Do they just want to know what's going on?
Yeah, no, I think that's a really great question. And what's interesting is if you think of jails and prisons, the purpose of them have changed over the years, right? Like they fundamentally or structurally have stayed the same. But the reality is what we use them for is uniquely different depending on the time frame or the era we are in. And one of the things that we recognize is that 95% of the people who go to jail or prison come out. They come back to our communities. They interact with our law enforcement colleagues and friends. They live in an environment and neighborhoods. And so one of the things that we're starting to recognize is that there's an incapacitative effect within prisons, but the rehabilitative effect is actually, the way we've run prison systems is really actually pretty limited. And that research over the last 100 years shows that taking someone out of the community and putting them in prison for X amount of time, but not providing a different path forward for them has actually demonstrated that people come out about the same. And I think what we want to do is honor the police that have done their job. And as a correction system, really think about how do we return people who they're going to come back to the community? How do we create an environment where the people who work in the prisons are safe? But also how do we create an environment where when they come back to or come out of a structured environment or an institution, that they're actually coming back in better case or better situations.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, when we talk about recidivism or being convicted of another crime within 3 to 5 years, whatever your state is using, the recidivism rate is high. 60%, 70% or more in some jurisdictions. So rehabilitation is key. Are you finding success?
In small pockets, there are places that are doing an amazing job and other places that are just terrible. But you're absolutely right. 70% of the people coming out of our traditional prison system, thin within 5 years. That's not a system that's being helpful. The problem is we have these beliefs, right? So one of the studies that Paula Smith and her colleagues did about the U.S. system found that, right, if you remember back in the 1980s, early 90s, we created these no-frill prisons. We took away education services. We took away social support services. We took away case managers. We said, we're going to make this place terrible to live in with the assumption that if we make it terrible, they won't want to come back. And what we found actually was that's the only time in our history that people left prison and reoffended at higher rates than lesser rates, right? Because think about it. Think about any of us. If you did something stupid, you did something against your partner or like said something horrible to them or cheated on them or whatever that is, and you're locked in a room for 3 years with no help, no support, no services, and no social connection to people, you're not coming out better. You're coming out worse. We know it from COVID. We were locked in our house with a TV with our family and came out mentally worse out of COVID. We can't expect that somehow people are going to miraculously get better if we take all the things away that are designed to help them get better while they're removed from the community. I think prisons are important. There's things that we need in our society. There are people who do horrible things that need to be removed. But I think what we have to rethink is that as soon as they're incarcerated, we have to think about what's the path out successfully and how do we create an environment where staff are safe, but that people are moving through it and are coming back better than, or at least hopefully not just equal, but better than when they came in. And that to me is where there are some jurisdictions that are headed to that are establishing our job is not to guard people while they're there. Our job is to help coach them into a better place in their life.
Yeah, and you're probably talking about the majority of the incarcerated, that there is some inroad into getting them rehabilitated. We've got that really, you know, that small percentage, you know better than anyone what that percentage is of retrobates that just cannot be rehabilitated. They're hardcore. They're probably offending inside. I talk to my students all the time and we talk about mental illness and we talk about solitary confinement or segregated housing. And they say abolish the segregated housing or the SHU. And I say, well, what do we do with these really hardened prisoners that are offending against their cellmates, against guards, against teachers, lawyers, whoever? Still, we have to have some sort of penalty box for those people, no?
Yeah, I think so. But I think it can look different, right? So Washington State did a study now a decade ago showing that they could take someone who was violently engaged in behavior and general pop, then when put in restrictive housing, as soon as they let them out of the room, they were violently engaging with staff and others, and that we actually can put them through a really structured treatment program and get them back to general pop and be safe. Right. So there are pathways, but you're right. You're not going to, and that's part of today's cancel culture world that I struggle with is like, let me show you some folks. If you don't think we need prisons, if you want to abolish prisons, let me show you a few folks and let's open your house for them and you can move in. Like, hell no. Like, prisons are important. Restrictive housing units are important. But no one's getting better locked in a room for 23 hours a day with no engagement, no treatment, no support, no way of addressing their mental health, and then coming out back to general pop. So then it gets us stuck in the cycle that if we can't help them, then we stick them there, and then we never let them out, and then they continue to get worse. And so what we're starting to see are places like Washington State, Missouri, Pennsylvania, that are starting to think differently about restrictive housing units. They're also thinking about differently the environment in which people live. And that there's a prison in Idaho, for example, who redesigned the structure of the prison so that people could be held accountable for some of their own personal care, like cooking, right? Instead of having someone cook and you stand in line, they're actually bringing food to the unit and having people help cook it and prepare it, not just as part of their job, but they're doing their own laundry. They're creating an environment that's outside of. Now, that doesn't mean that every person who comes to prison goes there, but what's really cool is they built this process where you demonstrate your ability to behave, you earn these types of sort of more, I hate to use the word freedom, but more ability to manage your life in an incarcerated event. And those are showing to be really powerful to help people get back to or become, for the first time ever, a pro-social participant. And then imagine someone walking out of prison who has the skills to take care of themselves, who has the belief that they can, has the self-efficacy to not rely on other people. That's what we want people coming back out of prison, is not relying on the system and the people who are back in the communities, but being able to come out and take care of themselves.
Yeah, no, that all makes sense. And when you talk about rehabilitation and maybe some non-traditional forms of rehabilitation, like turning somebody into, if they're interested in cooking, into a cook, or in California, we've had great success with wildfire fighters learning the trade and really have an impact, because we've had so many forest fires in California. Is there a move afoot to fill some of these other gaps on the outside, if you will, in healthcare? You know, when we prioritize release of prisoners, whether it was COVID related or if there's a statewide mandate by a court to release prisoners, well, we would probably prioritize those who've served the most of their sentence, maybe the elderly, maybe people who have some sort of illness, or they require health care. Shouldn't we be training some of the prisoners getting released how to get into that managed health care for aging and older prior incarcerated people?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, there's all sorts of industries that we can start to and are doing in some places, right? There's coding. Right. So California, San Quentin has a coding program where they're teaching people who are incarcerated around program coding of computers and sort of right and building this future tech piece of it and being able to backfill positions that historically have gone overseas. And we lose that capacity to build chips in our own country. And so that absolutely we've got to reinvest. Right. But if we think of, I think part of the problem is we think of people who go to prison in our country often is they deserve punishment and they shouldn't get job related skills while they're in prison because they're being punished. And I understand that feeling, right? I understand the desire to punish someone for doing something really bad to someone. But the reality is that we have to give them a path forward. We can't get them stuck. And to your point about the firefighters in California, one of the biggest travesties are that these folks were working, dying on the front lines, inhaling smoke next to a person who's free, and then they get paroled or released, and they can't have that job because there are barriers to getting to be a firefighter that your prior record keeps you from being a firefighter when you're in the community, but when you're in prison, you can go do it. So we also have to challenge our belief that what we've done in our past should hold us from being able to be in our future. And there's, right, like, if I think about, like, how do we reintegrate people who come from prison back into communities? It's that we make them part of our community. And what we've done is created these collateral consequences. So for example, and I get the logic, so I'm not arguing against it, but if someone commits a felony at 19 and I can't remember how many, 30 or 40 of the states, they can't vote for the rest of their life. Like, how do you become part of a citizenry at 27 when you're released and you don't feel outcasted, but you don't get to participate in the political process? And the idea, right, is like, oh, well, they shouldn't be able to establish laws that keep them from, it's like, but they should be able to establish their representatives. And that's what I think we have to rethink, is like, we have this belief that if we take their driver's license, if we take the way that, their voting rights, if we never let them have a gun, if we never let them do all these things, that somehow they're going to come back and just survive in the middle and not hurt people. And it's like, if we want to keep people from hurting people, we need to bring them into the community and into integrated in and say, look, you're a valuable person here and we're not going to let you fail. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where a big gap is that we've created, right, this process where you leave prison, you get $48, you get a bus ticket and no employable skills. And we have to change that if we want to truly break the cycle of returning 70% of the time, is people have to leave with some level of supportive housing, with some level of support around employment and some skills. And that doesn't detract from the fact that they may have hurt someone 20 years ago, but I don't want them to hurt another person. And I get the need for that, but I think we have to rethink how people leave our facilities. And I think you are right on leaving with a skill and filling the gaps of our current place where we can't get enough healthcare workers or we can't get enough people who are doing X, Y, Z is the perfect place for me to start thinking about this is where it needs to happen.
Yeah, for sure. And I think going back to the firefighters, I think that loophole was closed. I think there are exceptions now for, awesome, for formerly incarcerated professional firefighters to get jobs. And we have a don't check the box on your arrest record until your hiring date anyhow in California. So I think that's been fixed. I mean, otherwise we are just warehousing people and we're footing the bill to keep them right in or out of custody. And I want to talk to you a little bit about probation and parole, because what people don't realize is once they're released, and they're under the umbrella of the courts under probation or parole, it's almost as if they're still in custody, but out on OR, if you will, their own recognizance. I want to talk about that in a minute, but first I'd like to thank our sponsor. Officer Store, equipping protectors with passion. That's how we operate, and it's how we live. We understand that having the right gear can mean the difference between life and death. Our goal is to get you the gear you need, when you need it, at prices you can afford. Visit us at officerstore.com. And we're back, and we're talking about the incarcerated, jails, prisons, probation, parole, talking with Dr. Brian Lovins, Principal for Justice System Partners, on using data to improve corrections, and talking about probation and parole. In California, we revamped the system under a couple of assembly bills, AB 109 realignment, talked about downsizing prisons from over 140% of capacity to under 100. That made sense, but we also built a moratorium on no new prisons, so really limited capacity. So we released people from physical custody under the umbrella of probation and parole. I've had probation and parole officers come to my classes to talk to students, to try to recruit them. And I always ask about the span of control from a probation or parole officer to the number of people that they supervise. And it's usually some ungodly number. And the last person I talked to said 1 to 40, one probation officer to 40 people being supervised. I have the hand quotes going for supervised in the field. What's your take on that?
Yeah, Joe, I think they're lucky. There are cases that are 110, 120, 150 to caseload, 1-2. And then there's some that are 1 to 12, depending on the level of need that people have. I think here's the problem that we have with our post-adjudication supervision model, probation, parole, is that I have three kids, three teenagers. So my caseload is shared between my wife and I. So we have 3 to 2, and we still can't watch them enough to make them not break the rules, right? Like, surveillance doesn't stop people from breaking the rules. It just increases our likelihood of catching them if they're struggling. And so I think the problem with our probation parole system as well has been that we've created the same sort of model that we've created for prison, is that we're going to punish people out of crime. And the reality is most people that come to probation are struggling. They don't come with eagerness and say, thank God I finally got a probation officer. I've been wanting one of these for 20 years. They come with problems. They come with barriers. And then what happens often is that the system just puts more tripwires in their way and trips them up on stupid stuff when we're really worried about these things. And so I'll give you a good example. Like, and this is a crazy example, but, and I get, again, I get the judge that ordered it. There was a judge who ordered in a jurisdiction, ordered a person, he was drinking and driving, and the person he hit was drinking and driving. So by chance, two drinking and drivers are coming at an intersection. The person that died ran the red light. The person who was drinking and driving was going through a green light. They hit the person and killed the one that ran the red light. The story is that what happened was that the person was found not guilty for vehicular homicide, even though they were drinking and driving, because they weren't breaking the law. The person that ran the red light was at fault for the accident. The judge got pissed because the person didn't get charged with the loss of life. And so he ordered the person to wear a sign that said, I killed your teacher, because the person who died was a teacher, outside of a class, outside of a school at lunchtime. And so here's these 16, 17, 18-year-olds driving out, and this dude's got a sign that says, I killed your teacher on it. And they were throwing stuff at him. Someone got out of the car and threatened to beat him up. And it's like, that's a condition of supervision. Now, that's a rare condition. But there are things like pay fees. There are things like go to treatment during the day when you have a job. And now I have to choose, do I continue to stay employed or do I go to treatment? There are things that are the rules, like don't leave the county. I mean, think about that. Like, you live in a border county, like you drive one block over and you're in another county and you have this rule that you can't leave the county, you're in trouble. And like, and then now you're scared to leave the county. And it's like, oh, I can't go over to my friend's house who's pro-social. I can't go to work because it's across county lines without permission. We've created this really set of traps. And really what we should be doing is thinking about ourselves less as, like, as I use this analogy of referees, and thinking about we have the rules and we're watching for people violating them, to coaches, right? Because coaches' role in a game is to help people win without cheating. Referees' role is to not let people cheat to win. And I think what we really have to start to think about is people need people helping them win without cheating more than they need to catch them cheating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you did a great job contributing to this webinar and the publication on Police One After with my editor, Nancy Perry. And you talked about those things you're talking about, the technical violations, right? That we're there watching to catch people. But when we talk about technical violations, we're asking the person to be released to sign away their Fourth Amendment rights, usually search and seizure, to being searched on the street or after hours, after a curfew ordered by a judge. Can't the technical violations be used to interrupt possible criminality or larger crimes? I mean, we're talking in generalities today, but I'm thinking of those in gang association, drug possession, the frequent flyers, the chronic recidivist. Mm-hmm. What about cutting off, disabling, or not charging their ankle monitor? I mean, the good thing is when they keep it on, sometimes we can track them going to the crime they commit and place them at the scene of the crime. But aren't those technical violations in place for those sort of frequent flyers, the high offenders?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the problem is there's not a lot of evidence to support that they stop the people who are likely to engage. But I mean, but there are a lot of false positives, right? There's a lot of problems with it. Think about your cell phone. You got to charge it every day. If you forget to charge it, you're not answering the text from your partner and getting mad, like getting in trouble, right? Like the same thing's true. Like we're human beings. I forget to charge my ankle monitor. Now I'm going to jail. But the problem is we can't tell the difference between you forgot and got distracted or you fell asleep on the couch and you're going out to commit a crime, and that's why you haven't done it. And so there's a huge net widening we see with these that we've got to be more precise. I appreciate your point. Like, there are some people, like I said earlier, like, there are people who need to go to prison. There are people who need direct monitoring. The problem is we haven't created a system that actually focuses on that small population. We've created a system that's starting to net widen into a lot of people. And so it's down 1 million in the last 2 years, but we 2 years ago, we had 4.6 million people on probation and parole. Like, now we're down to 3.7, but the reality is that's a lot of people who may or may not need these trip wires. There are some people, absolutely. We just got to do a better job. We're a country of risk averse. And so, like, if there's a scary thing, we're going to do it to everyone to make sure it doesn't happen. And I get that. I have kids. I want to make sure that they're safe. But I also recognize, like, we do trip people back up. 60% of the people who go back to prison are for a technical violation and not a crime. And so, like, yes, people shouldn't be able to uncharge there or let their electronic monitoring sort of run out of battery. People shouldn't use drugs. People shouldn't drive without a license. But some of those things, I mean, imagine you live in an area without public transportation, or you live in an area with public transportation. Most of us don't take that either. Like, we like the reliance on our cars in this country. And then to say to someone, you got six places to go in a week to maintain your probation, but you can't drive them. How many rides can you get from pro-social people? So what happens is they call their buddies. Their buddies are the ones that don't have jobs, and they're the ones we don't want them hanging out with. And they're like, hey, can you take me to treatment? I'll steal some shit for you. Or I'll like the reality is, like, there's social capital that goes along with this stuff. So I think we got to be more, less broadband brush strokes of people. And we really, truly got to go back to a process where we individualize interventions. And then for this one person, that's right. But because this one person did this same thing, doesn't mean it's right for them. And I think that's the system that really improves our practice, is the ability to iterate and not create these broad brushstrokes of everyone gets everything.
Yeah, for sure. And we talked about the span of control, and sometimes it is out of control of, you know, if you're supervising over 100 people, you're really not supervising. So what about AI? I just thought of this. AI is making inroads to everything, right? So we don't have enough parole officers, probation officers to look at everyone's social media, where you might be flashing money and guns, right? So what about AI? Are we looking to use that to do something like social media monitoring? Because they can certainly, I had somebody, Zero Eyes, that it's a program that will spot firearms off of existing video media, and it'll alert, the monitors. Mm-hmm. Are we starting to do something like that?
We see it in some places. I think it's tough, right? Because it is a court hearing. It's under a judge. Who owns the records often come in. And so using AI, you sort of have to be able to go to judicial records at times. And, like, there aren't a lot of judges that want artificial intelligence in the middle of their records. And so there are some barriers to doing that. Mm-hmm. I think the places that I would challenge us to think about is twofold. One is, absolutely, we should use AI, and there are places that start to generate sort of flags for us to lean in. I think the answer to what we find may not be necessarily violations, but it's to sort of help people recognize there's better paths to improve practices, to improve interventions, and not let people escape out of bad behavior. But I think there are definitely pieces. I would argue that we have to think of technology both from the surveillance side, but also the support side. Like, I have a ton of support mechanisms on my phone. I've got health apps. I can record my, or I can measure my blood pressure from my phone. Like, the only reason I remembered this podcast, not because it wasn't important, but because I got a calendar reminder 10 minutes ahead. Like, we've got to think about, how do we use technology not just to catch people, But I actually think people are more interested in staying out of crime than they are staying in it. And so giving them mechanisms to also understand themselves better using AI and what it is that can help them become better or more successful in their life is important as well.
Yeah. And you're all about data. You're all about using data. What are we learning from data? Can we identify traits and behaviors that lead to terminating parole and probation? Are we making things better through data?
Yeah, I think so. I think where people, the trend is, and you guys know this in the law enforcement side, data driven. The problem is, I think there's a lot of people who just know those words and don't really understand what it means. And not from the policing side, but more so from the correction side. Like, we hear it a lot, but then we dig into it. And it's like, well, we have our recidivism rates. It's like, that's not really data driven. And so some of the things I think are really exciting are, imagine, like, if you were going to go to a therapist, and not to make the direct connection of a therapist and a, but let's take a coach. I think that's more realistic. If you're going to put your kid on a coach, a team, you would assess for the quality of the coach. Do they have the right traits? Do they act? Do they know how to win? Do they know all these things? The reality is, when you get put on probation, you get the next person up. You can have a good relationship with them. They can be good at their job. They can be really not so good at their job. They could be good with certain populations. And so what we're starting to really think about, like, is how do we actually match the right people under the right circumstances? And that's, I think, a great place for data to happen, is how do we connect the right people to the right type of officer that's going to help them? Some people need the accountable person. Some people need the support coaching person. We need to be able to match that up better so that they can be successful. So we've seen some of that. One of the things that we see a lot is on the intervention side or the treatment side is cognitive behavioral interventions are more successful than others, meaning that if we can get people to understand what their thinking is, how that drives their behavior, if we can help them shift the way they think, we're going to help them change their behavior. And so we've seen a lot of good research around programs that do that, as well as programs that reduce barriers, right? And that, so we've seen a lot better success. So one of the things that I love about California, for example, while I know it was burdensome to local jurisdictions, is that there's a lot of good research that people coming out of prison, they're connected to people, connected to family members and local support, are more successful. But when you run a state system as big as California, you could be in Southern California and be incarcerated in Northern California, and it's a plane ride to go see your son or your daughter. Local has allowed for a significant increase in the number of people who can see the people incarcerated, and they can support their transition back to the community. You can also wrap around social service agencies more easily when people are held locally, because your social service agent can go into the facility or come on to the parole team to be part of that. And so I think we're seeing a lot of good data around the more connected we can make people to their support teams, the more we can help them change their thinking, and the more that we can sort of tie them to programs that are effective, the better our system becomes.
Yeah. Hey, I want to be respectful of your time. I so appreciate you taking time to share with us. I'm a new agency. I'm coming to you for advice. What is the single most thing that comes to mind when you get a new client and you advise them? What are we missing? What are we missing in our correction systems?
I love that question. I think we're missing, there's a lot of good research coming out of Europe, and we're doing some of this coaching work. We're missing the fact that for people to change, they have to have a relationship with the person that's designed or standing there to help them change. And I think in our correction system, often we've created this us-them barrier that we're against you. And that we really have to change that and think of it much like a coach. And that our job is to help you win, not catch you failing. And that doesn't mean, right? Think about a coach. We're still, coaches hold people accountable. If coaches didn't hold someone accountable, we have a name for that coach. It's a Dallas Cowboys coach, right? Or an ex-coach, if you will, if you're a Dallas Cowboys fan, right? Like, the reality is, like, coaches still hold people accountable. It's not some willy-nilly let people do what they want to do. But for people to change, they have to have someone invested in them. And I think if we created a system that said, you screwed up. For a path back, here is your coach. Their job is to help you figure out how to win without cheating. And they get to know you and build a plan with you and build a success plan. And that there are going to be people I kick off my team 100%. They got to go to a different coach in a different setting, incarceration. But that my job is to hold you accountable, but also to teach you ways to live within the system successfully. I think that's the right intervention at all levels for us, is really rethinking. The role isn't to referee people and catch them failing, but the role is to help them stay on the field and win.
Yeah, I gotcha. Well, I have linked the PDF to your article that you talk about how data is helping with our corrections. And, you know, we got to cut down the recidivism rate, because all we are is paying for these people to, you know, commit crime, go back. And it's hard to rearrest and convict and get somebody sentenced. But, you know, it takes a ton of money to house people in custody or out. So we got to do something. Hey, thanks for being on the show, Dr. Brian Lovins, principal for Justice Systems Partners on using data to improve corrections. What do you got in the works? What's coming out?
I think it's a really cool one around drug testing. We actually use a lot of drug testing, and we don't really have a good sense of what it does. And so we actually have a new research study looking at what happens if we drug test or don't drug test people without a substance use issue. So look for that. I think that's one of the exciting sort of pieces we're challenging of the system.
Nice. All right.
I appreciate what you do. I love the fact that you're giving information and sort of talking directly to the people. And I really appreciate the time that you've given me. I know it took up a lot, but I'm excited to learn more about the organization and the folks and how we can work together across systems to make it a better world.
Yeah, for sure. And same. I mean, we need to hear about what happens to people beyond the conviction, what happens. And we want to make sure our corrections people are trained and safe as well. So I want to get you back on to talk about them and more in depth about the training and safety for people behind the walls. Take good care.
You too.
Hey, to our listeners, thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed today's show. Insightful. And if you have any comments or questions, drop me a line at policingmatters@policeone.com. policingmatters@policeone.com. Hey, take good care. Hope to talk to you again real soon.